Welcome to the West Harlem Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinniston, and this is episode 19. The West Harlem Way Race is now just under 4 weeks away. The race starts at 1 o'clock on the 23rd of June, and hopefully this podcast will, I'm recording this on Sunday evening on the 27th, so by the time it goes out tomorrow, the race is less than 4 weeks away. So I thought it'd be quite helpful to have a little thoughts on tapering this week, but before that, I have my favourite blog post of the week is from Julie. Julie is someone who has been following the West Harlem Way and following the ultra race of the last year, and writes a really entertaining blog. So I've read out her latest post where she talks about the recent Fling race. And then that's about 18 minutes long. And then the next part you'll hear is an interview I did with Caroline. We've been following Caroline's progress over the last number of weeks now. I think it's the fourth one that we've done. And Caroline just talks a little bit about her two-day run and the training she's done over the last few weeks, and then what she plans to do between now and the race, and also what her goals are for the race itself. So it's been good to follow Caroline's progress, and I hope you've enjoyed that as well. And again, that lasts about 18 minutes. And then I thought it'd be good to do something on tapering. It's one of those things that it's never easy, really, to know how to taper before a big race, whether it's a West Harlem Way or another ultra race or even a marathon or 10K even. You know, it's the same sort of principles. So I thought it'd be quite helpful. So I met with Neil after he was supporting Caroline and Zilka and Katrina yesterday. And we had a little chat together about what we've done in our tapering and maybe some of the lessons that we've learned. And hopefully there's some good ideas and some good things that you can either accept and think, yeah, it's good, or nah, it won't work for me, and try something else. But anyway, I hope you find that helpful as well. So enjoy the podcast. Lasts just under an hour or so, I think, this one. And three different things: Julie, Caroline, and then Neil and myself. Where do we go to draw the line? I've got to say, I wasted all your time. My favourite blog post of the week is from Julie. And Julie is someone who's not run an ultra race, but over the last year or so, she's really been involved on supporting and marshalling, and has really enjoyed it. And she writes a very, very entertaining blog called Watching the Trails, an ordinary woman's fascination with an extraordinary sport and the extraordinary people who take part. And Julie first got involved a year ago at the Fling in 2011. And so this report, written on Thursday, the 24th of May, 2012, is reflecting on that and talking about the Marsh being involved in the 2012 Fling. And it's a great read, and I thought I'd read that out. If you want to read Julie's blog, then the address is ultra-watcher.blogspot.co.uk. So this is Julie's post from Thursday, 24th of May, 2012, a far-off Fling. I've been told there was no Fling blog, mea culpa. I've been busy. I've been travelling and working too hard. I keep on thinking I'll do it tomorrow, or maybe next week, or sometime. There's other stuff going on in my life. But like running, the first step out the door is the hardest. So here we are, a few weeks late, but someone has to be last, don't they? This is, sort of, my birthday race. A year ago, I hauled myself up Connick Hill and watched my first competitive ultra. All the things, all the people that led me to. Stupidly, I made no arrangements for accommodation before or after the race. Work is interesting at the moment, and I was struggling to predict where I'd be on the Friday, knowing only that there wasn't a cat in hell's chance of me not taking a day off. I didn't catch up with John Duncan, the new race director, until nearly a week before the event, finally agreeing that I'd be on finish line duties. Deja vu all over again. But this year, there would definitely be no Katrina Kinniston, This year she had moved over to the dark side and was running the fling herself. I looked to see if there was any late accommodation, but not a chance. The two big hotels in Tyndrum take only coach parties, not individual bookings, and Tyndrum Lodge had been full for months. I grizzled on Facebook, and Bill Ayres offered a spare bed in his room in the By The Way hostel. Great, no need for a long drive home and a chance for a few drinks afterwards. Don't think I've stayed in a hostel since primary school trips, but everyone raves about By The Way, it'll be fine. Friday saw me in London, doing battle with the DLR and Tube, and thinking wistfully of how much better the scenery and people were going to be 24 hours later. In the early evening, I sat at City Airport, watching increasingly frustrated status updates from would-be flingers trying to fly from Heathrow and Gatwick into Glasgow, and the early notes and photos from the latest mad jaunt of George and Karen on the first leg of their down-and-up fling double. A slightly late start on the Saturday morning, bags packed, and I'm heading west for the first time this year. Too early for midges, the sun is blazing down with the promise of another glorious day. Does the fling have a booking for it, a deal with Mother Nature to show several hundred runners Western Scotland at its magnificent best? In no time at all, I'm at Tyndrum, bumping down the road to Lower Tyndrum Station. Despite being a tiny settlement, Tyndrum has two railway stations on two entirely separate lines that have no connection. To travel from one to the other by rail involves a journey of several hundred miles past the finish line. Already there are a few people there unloading boxes and vans, starting to deal with the finishing arch. I intended to go and have lunch at the Real Food Cafe, maybe to have the chips I never yet ate, but I introduced myself to a man who looks enough like John to clearly be relevant. I made the fatal mistake of asking if there's anything I can do to help, and find myself eyeing up two tarpaulins and a pile of finished bags that range from small supermarket carrier bags to full-scale suitcases. There are nearly 500 individual runners in the fling, and another 200 or so in the relay teams. It looks like each and every one of them has sent a bag through to the finish line. So myself and another set to work, trying to lay them out in some type of order. Most have numbers attached, in various degrees of clarity and accessibility. Some have nothing and will just go into a pile together. Hopefully the runner will have enough wit left after 53 miles to recognise their own, if not enough to put a number on it in the first place. Many of the bags have names on as well, and I'm quite stunned by how many I recognise. This world of Scottish ultras is small, slightly too large to be a family, but perhaps a small tribe instead. When all this is done, I retrieve a can of ginger beer from the car and wander back to the finish point where the arch is now up and tethered. I'm torn between sadness and delight to see the familiar faces of George and Karen, two of the nicest people I know. I'm always happy to see them, but they should be out on the way, heading north with the other runners. Instead, they pulled out overnight after George fell on the southern-bound leg and hurt his knee. No doubt he carried on for many more miles than any sane person would, but eventually decided that the damage and pain were beyond dealing with. So no double and no fling. But Karen tells me of looking at the stars blazing down on them and the snow-topped hills during the night, and you remember that, much of the time, the journey far outweighs the destination. Then I really am back where it all started, looking at a table with stacks of boxes and bags on, embryonic goodie bags, those things you get handed at the end of a race containing food and vouchers and alcohol and magnets, and every one of them needs to be packed, several hundred of them for this race. So time to get going on it, get a head start now before any finishes, and hopefully we'll never run out, even though I'll still be packing as darkness falls into the evening. Time for the women to start a production line. Even Muriel is here again, packing bags before starting her stint as finish line photographer. Not a role I ever wished to sign up for after my incompetence at the D33. This year the fling is sponsored by Hoka, makers of the controversial running shoes. Now, to celebrate, they've sent their sponsored athletes to compete. An interesting dynamic to add these semi-professional runners to the predictions. This year there will be no Consanis, no Jez, no Kate or Lucy. In some ways the most open contest for a while, in others the most obscure. One of the things about the fling is the staggered start times. It makes perfect sense, and you can't possibly deal with letting 500 plus runners loose in Mulgai at once. But it also means that the first person to cross the finish line isn't necessarily the winner. Even more confusingly, there is an option for the older men to join the last wave, which leaves at 8 rather than their scheduled 6 or 7 start. Add in the relay teams and it makes it all far too confusing to follow. There is also a problem with the chip timing system. The information from the earlier checkpoints feeds to a server in Holland, which is not issuing any data. Without this vital piece of technology, race control has no idea what's happening down the course. Not surprisingly, however, the first arrival, signalled as always by the sound of the piper echoing up the path and a radio call from George on the bridge, is Emma Roker, the Hoka female runner. There is a camera crew interviewing all the early finishers, which I assume is for some Hoka promotional material, but never really find out. Not far behind are the second and third females, an Irish-sounding girl I don't recognise, and Sharon Law, looking as pretty and unexerted as ever. Somewhere there is a bad photo of that girl, but it probably doesn't involve her wearing running gear. The first man to finish is Thomas, the crazy German, who can't really have that nickname much longer, having been scheduled to run for Scotland later in the summer. This year there are no medical dramas, only a few hundred yards from the line, and he finishes with a wide grin to be greeted by the Consani family, who are his support crew today. Zilka, his wife, is also running the full fling ahead of her first assault on the West Harlem Way next month. The men's winner arrives later, someone I've heard of but not met or seen before, Scott Bradley, who features heavily in the Adventure Show episode and the West Harlem Way race from a few years ago. He was taken seriously ill after a Hardmoor's Ultra last year, but is now back and racing very well. His father, who had been at the finish for some time and also seems to know everyone, looks very relieved. Scott just looks happy. As well as sponsored runners, Hoka have a stall at the finish promoting their product. In the gaps between arrivals, I get talking to one of the team. He tells me that Ludo, their male runner, is not keen on the route. It's too flat. I make a strange, strangled noise. My legs still remember Connick Hill from 12 months ago and all the photos of the ups and downs along the lough and the roller coaster into Crianlarich. Too flat? But after a few more questions, I realise that for some people, anything that doesn't involve going up and down mountains is flat. I'm stunned and impressed and realise how little I still know. There's bad news down the course. One of the women, Ellen, has taken a bad fall near Loch Lomond. It's not clear if she's broken or dislocated her shoulder, and there's a long wait for the ambulance, which is not surprising in the location. Despite the heat of the day, both she and Santa, who stopped with her, are struggling to keep warm whilst immobile. Those little metallic heat blankets have since become mandatory kit for the West Harlem Way. In the early stages, the finishers arrive singly with gaps, and there's time to keep an eye out for runners I know. Richie finishes well. Whereas last year he was greeted at the finish by his new girlfriend, this year he has a wife and son to welcome him. It's nice to see that fatherhood hasn't slowed him down, and I can't help thinking what he's going to achieve in the West Harlem Way race. The lovely Antonia arrives about 10 to 4. For someone only starting her second season of ultras, she's delivering some great performances. She's even more interestingly, she's the youngest contestant in the West Harlem Way race by far. I think back to a drunken conversation at the Sums presentation last year, debating that many of the top Scottish runners only move to the distance at a much older age. How much better might they be if they had started in their 20s at the alleged peak of their physical fitness? Just behind her is Andy, my normal runner from the Devils, also the man whose tongue-in-cheek advice led me to run my fastest ever mile a few weeks earlier. Although older than Antonia, he's another newcomer to the distance, still learning how good he can be. Soon after this, the runners start coming thick and fast, and I lose sight of who's finishing. I'm also that bit further away from the roadway, and have no sight line through the crowds of finishers and supporters. Though I do hear the roar when John and Katrina finish. Katrina is a pace or two ahead, and I'm sure John is far too much of a gentleman to claim he allowed her to do so. Runners arrive in all states and conditions, some battered and bruised, some almost beaten, and most managing to run the last few hundred yards up to the finish line. But one of the most striking has to be the runner who arrives in buff, shorts and shoes and nothing else. I'm told he ran the entire course in this state of undress. No race will be complete without the Carnegie colours, and no race on the West Harlem Way without Fiona and Pauline. On this occasion, finishing with Sue, in a blaze of smiles as bright as their club vests and as Scottish as the mini kilts. The sunshine lasts all day, until there's a blast of hail during the prize giving as dusk starts to fall. I'm still packing and handing out bags, cursing the boxes of pink fizz that have to be opened and lifted. My back and legs are aching, proving my lack of fitness. As the day turns to evening, people finally drift off. There are still a few runners out on the course, not least the two Daves who are sweeping the final stretch from Benglass. But most of all, out there still is the legend that is Ray McCurdy on his 100th ultra. It's not over until the fat lady sings. It's not over until Ray crosses the finish line. He keeps us waiting, but finally. Despite the shortness of my day, I feel I could sleep for a week, but I also feel like celebrating with the family. So time to find my berth, maybe change some clothes and head up to the Cayley. Bill's told me which cabin we're in, and I know Fiona, MacD and MacRae are in there as well. Unfortunately, by the time I get there, it's locked and empty. Ah. Too tired to think, I abandon my bags on the porch and go hunting. There is no sign of any of them in Paddy's bar, so I go looking for the village hall. I think it's up behind Brodie's store, which is a very dark path by now. Then I can hear the noise of a party, and there we are. White wine, veggie curry and rice, other than a cup of soup, my first food of the day. Friends to talk to, and all is right with the world. I no doubt talk nonsense at some point, getting carried away by the adrenaline of the day. But I do at least have the wit not to dance. Fiona is here, and somehow Bill is texting George while I'm sat at the same table, so I know I'll be able to get into the cabin to sleep later. There is a presentation for Ray for his achievement. Only a few of the people have ever achieved 100 ultras. Among the awards is free entry to the Sums races for life, so maybe there will be a lot more than 100. However, I think the McCurdy sandwich is the highlight of Ray's night. Too long living in the city has left me entirely unprepared for the fact that the road to the hostel is unlit, and therefore pitch black at the wrong side of midnight. I manage not to fall over any curbs or bounce into any cars, but it's close. Back at the cabins, I'm totally horrified to discover that I'm sleeping in a bunk, a top bunk. Climbing into a top bunk may be fun when you're a small, skinny child, but when you're overweight and middle-aged, it's bloody awkward and alarmingly creaky. I also feel guilty about disturbing the three people who have run 53 miles each today. There also is Nelly Bedlinen. Due to my own stupidity, I don't have a sleeping bag either. Oh well, I'll sleep in my clothes with the single blanket I have in my bag. Good plan. But it's absolutely feckin' freezing. I'm told I did sleep briefly as I snored very loudly. I don't remember sleeping at all. When I start shivering to the point that I'm shaking the bunk unit, I realise I can't spend the night like that. Whilst it's cold outside, I swear it's warmer than inside the cabin. The toilet shower block is warm but rank and damp, can't stay there. But there is a kitchen room in the same building, and I doze on a plastic chair. As dawn breaks, I have an inspiration, filling and boiling the kettle in turn to turn it into a hot water bottle, and so Fiona finds me later hugging a kettle. I fear I may never hear the last of it. Next time, better planning. I didn't make the catering race, but judging by reports, I missed a great weekend. Next year, and in just over 4 weeks, I'll be at Kinlochleven again. I can't wait. Where do I go to fall from grace? God put a smile upon your face. Yeah. Welcome to our podcast, and we have Caroline with us on her journey of the West Harlem Way. It's now Friday, the 25th of May, so the race is 4 weeks tomorrow. So this time in 4 weeks, folks will be heading to Mulgai to register and start the race at 1 o'clock the following morning. So we've been following Caroline's progress over the last number of weeks, and we did the last one, we reckon, 5 weeks ago, just after Caroline had done her fling and before the main fling race. So, Caroline, tell us a little bit about how you feel with the race just 4 weeks away.
Surprisingly, this last week or so, I feel like I've not thought about it very much. I've just been really busy with work and had to focus on that. So I've not been thinking about how I'm going to feel or anything during the actual race, but I do think about the logistics quite a lot, but that's probably because I can sort of, that's something I can try and organise. So that feels a bit easier. In some ways it feels like it's still really far away, and then in others it feels like it's really close, and I think that's because partly I know now at this point there's nothing else I can do now that's going to make much difference apart from doing too much. It was good to be supporting at the Catherine last week and just get back into the way of being in that kind of environment and seeing that kind of run again to get me sort of thinking about it as well.
And Neil did very well last week, did he?
Yes, he did. Surprised himself.
Yeah, I think he finished just 9:27.
Yep.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about how your training's gone over the last few weeks since we did the last one.
I've done nearly everything that I really planned to do in terms of long runs. I've not done as much as I should have during the week, but yeah, I was kind of recovering from my own fling, which I think did take me a little while. I mean, it's only the third time I've done that kind of distance, so it's not surprising my legs would, you know, take a while to get over that. And just sort of time-wise and with a few work things going on, didn't get as much done as I would wanted, but didn't really do anything much the first weekend after the fling. Was just supporting Neil on a training run for the Catherine. We had the wedding the next weekend that was the actual fling weekend, so I did get 17 miles done in the Great Glen Way that day, which was quite good. And then we did have about a 20 or a 24 planned the week after that, but I was wrecked, and not from alcohol, just wrecked, tired. And Neil had been on duty the night before, so he had no sleep, so we ended up just doing 12 miles, but it was a really good 12 miles sort of over Connick twice, and not even going in the actual path, going up and over different paths and things like that. So a really, really good hill training workout, which I think did me a lot of good. And then the next weekend was my two-day weekend, which I know there's a question about later, so I'll come back to that. And after that, I was pretty tired. So last weekend, I just did 8 miles on the Catherine on the Sunday, but going up and over Glen Shee, so another good sort of hill session there.
So you mentioned there that the obviously the two-day training run was the big one of this last 5 weeks. And there was quite a bit of discussion, and still is, I think, about what to do and the best way of doing it. But you felt to do a two-day training run, actually on the route. So tell us a little bit about how that went, because the 2 days were very different, weren't they?
I was quite nervous before the two-day training run actually started, particularly the Friday night. In fact, Neil always knows now. He was like, "You're worried about this, aren't you?" Because I was kind of not talking. But he was then away on duty on the Saturday. So Saturday was fine. I had Katrina with me for the first 20 miles. That was great. Just trotting along, kept it nice and steady. Did the kind of different sections and the paces I kind of usually do them, really. And then at Ben Glass, when Katrina stopped and John was joining me at Derry Darrock, I started to get my throat thing, and that just made me kind of suffer a bit for the rest of it. And my legs did die at Tindrum as well a bit. But I was pleased to keep up a decent walking pace, which was probably only because John was there. I know I can walk fast, but I do tend to be lazy by myself a bit. And stayed the night in the Bridge of Orkey Hotel. Took a bit of stick from Neil for not just staying in the bunkhouse, but there was no way I wasn't having a nice hotel room for the night after that, and with what was coming the next day. Had a cold bath that night, which I swear really, really helps me with recovery of my legs, if you can bear it, and wore my skins overnight and things. Did see the weather forecast on Saturday night, and the forecaster was saying Sunday was not going to be a day to be out in the Scottish Highlands. But, well, he was right. Woke up on the Sunday, torrential rain, gale force winds. It was just horrendous. But I was feeling, it was hard work going from Bridge of Orkey over to Glencoe. Really hard, but I was feeling really positive about it, thinking that, yeah, I can do this and I can keep going and it's fine. But a couple of miles before Glencoe, just when you're sort of climbing up again before you come down and before you start the descent into the ski centre, I had to go into my third pair of gloves that I had with me, which was my ski gloves. Couldn't even get them on properly. I hadn't eaten anything because my hands were so cold that I couldn't get to anything. It was just starting to get a bit too miserable, although I was still adamant to myself that I was going to be carrying on, and I'd had Deb's and Sharon's podcast to keep me company over Rannoch Moor. We were supposed to be meeting Neil at Glencoe, but he wasn't there yet, so I made my way down to King's House, struggling at that point to stay on my feet because the wind was just trying to knock me over, and it was doing the same with all these walkers in front of me. There was two accidents on the A82 as I crossed the road as well. Neil wasn't at King's House yet either, so I was starting to get a bit worried as I definitely needed a change of clothes. But just as I was leaving to go to the staircase, he met me, and first thing he said was, "You're not carrying on in this," and I'm going, "Yes, I am." So he collected my bag and got me a cup of tea, and I went in to get changed, and he thought I was coming out in my hoodie and my tracksuit bottoms, and I came out in a full new set of running kit. He made me have the cup of tea first, and he was like, "I'd feel a bit better about you going out if you were actually, you know, not shivering uncontrollably and things." Eventually we compromised and he decided to come out with me, and we lasted 5 minutes, and then he just turned me back round because I wasn't even moving anymore with the wind. But I just felt so guilty for stopping and thinking that I shouldn't have been, and that I should have been tough enough to carry on and man up and so on, thinking that other people would have carried on. I only really felt better the next day when John texted me to say that Gaynor and Tracy, that we'd met on the Saturday, had pulled out of Glencoe as well. So that made me feel better that other people hadn't carried on. Plus, every walker that came into King's House was looking for accommodation for the night because they couldn't carry on either. And I want to say thank you to everyone who's left comments on my blog about really the fling run and that 2 day run, saying, you know, not to be too hard on myself because of what happened and things. So that was very much appreciated. And I think, although I did sound like I was hard on myself, it was also just because I was disappointed, because through sheer determination and stubbornness, I have completed every other long run, and I just wanted to really, you know, complete what I'd set out at the start to do. So that was partly why that was so disappointing.
Yeah, I must say, you know, having been with you on Saturday, I thought you were going really well and strongly, and that I think you do have a good walking pace, and you kept a good pace going, and the fact that you felt well enough and good enough to be able to do the second day is actually a real positive sign. But from the comments I heard just from yourself and from others, it was just horrific out there on that Sunday, so I think that was the only wise decision you made, and that was good. Okay, so let's think about what are your plans for the next few weeks between now and 1 o'clock on the 23rd of June as far as training goes?
I really wasn't sure what I was going to do, actually. I was just waiting till after the 2 day run to see what happened after that. So because of that, tomorrow, myself and Silke and Katrina are going to go and run from King's House to Fort William. I really wanted to do that section again and just complete the whole sort of second half again. And Neil's going to support us with that, so he's on his day out with all the ladies tomorrow. That will be my last long run, and then next weekend, because it's a holiday weekend, I just want to get in consistent running over that few days, but nothing terribly long. John, you can give me some ideas on how long. I'm determined I'm going to have a sports massage every week. I've got one booked for Wednesday between now and the race, just to get my legs back in some sort of working order, and really, really need to get myself back into some good sleeping habits because I've not been sleeping well at all. So that's the main things now.
Yeah. Good. Now, we all know that the running is obviously the biggest part of the actual adventure and the race, but you've got the whole side of the support, logistics. So how is that coming together? Is that all in place?
It took a bit of time, mainly due to not knowing if Neil was actually going to be there or not, but he is, so I am sorted now. As soon as I knew that was me kind of wanting to get that in place, and I've now got more runners coming with me than I thought I would have, but you know, it's just people that I know really well and that really want to, so that's fine. So Neil's going to do the first night by himself, and I'm a bit worried about him being up the entire time. I think he kind of forgets that even though I've done his backup the whole way for 2 years, that I'm going to be out for considerably longer than he was, so it's, you know, it's going to be more tiring for him. But in the morning, after he's seen me at Rowden, he can go back to Balloch, and he's going to be up with Chris McGlennon from our club, and then Chris will bring his car up, so at least Neil won't really be doing much more driving if he is tired. And then, so they'll do support up to Glencoe, and then I've got my sister-in-law and a friend of ours, Keir, coming up to Glencoe, and they'll do some support from Glencoe up to Fort William as well as Neil and Chris. So I'm going to have one person running with me from Tindrum to Kinlochleven, so swapping between those four people, but only one at a time. And then I'm having Susan and Keir from Kinlochleven to Llandavra, and then Neil and Chris from Llandavra to Fort William, because I think I might need two people to keep me going by then. And partly as well because I might not have a lot of chat by then, but or want to talk, but I would like to just be able to listen to other people talking and things. So I think that I'll want to do that. And I had said to Susan the other night that then I wanted her and Keir to come to Braveheart Car Park as well, and we would all finish together. And that was definitely how I saw things, and she was very much of the mind, well, but you should get all the glory for that bit, and you should do that bit yourself. So I'm not sure about that bit. Yeah, I think I want them all with me, at least to the car park. So that's us sorted for that. I definitely want to be in and out of checkpoints really quickly, at least, you know, sort of up to Bridge of Orkney. Who knows what's going to happen after that. And I'm definitely going to be giving the support crew, Fiona Rennie's support notes that she put on Facebook, maybe slightly modified, but pretty much like that. You know, definitely, I think my leg seizes up a lot more quickly when I stop, so I want people walking out with me while I'm eating and things like that, just to keep me going.
Yeah. I think on the day you may find your thoughts change on that last little bit, but I think it'd be lovely if those who've been with you running, and they could always stop, say, at the roundabout,
yeah,
couldn't they?
Yeah.
And then either go ahead and see you in, or yeah, let you run in that last little bit. I thought it was interesting when we were chatting with Gaynor and Tracy, because Gaynor won the 100, Lakeland 100 last year, and her friend came out and he ran with her in coming into the finish and was saying, this is the leading lady, this is the one who's just won, she's done it 100 miles in 28 and a half hours. And I thought it was really nice. Yeah. You know, she had a little someone going ahead. So anyway, I'm sure whatever it is, it will be a great finish. I think the very first podcast, I think I might have asked you what sort of time you were thinking about. And so I thought it'd be quite interesting with just 4 weeks to go. I know you have, because you're that sort of, you like having your goals and your ideas. And I think it is helpful to have more than one, because this race, there's so many things, variables that can go right, can go wrong. So can you maybe tell us what you think your bronze, your silver and your gold medal goals are?
I'm kind of scared to admit them, and anyone who's listened to any of the podcasts or reads my blog knows that, you know, I kind of set myself up for things and then get terribly disappointed if I don't make the times that I want. So really all three, bronze, silver and gold, should probably just be finishing. But bronze medal is definitely just finishing. And I would really like to do it in under 30, or so that's my silver. And I've got my gold as being under 28. And then there was the kind of super, super, super gold of under 24, but I really don't think that I'm quite capable of that right now. So I'm just trying. I'm not thinking that I'm going to do that. That would just be an incredible bonus. I'm really just kind of looking at under 30 would be what I would like to do, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's sensible. And I think it gives you, you know, the last 6 months, you've committed a lot of time and effort to this. And I think you want to do the very best you can, can't you? So I hope that works out. Right, I just got two final questions and then maybe a final comment. Okay, so the first question to finish with, what are you looking forward to most about the race?
Okay, finishing. I actually, when I was thinking about it to answer this question, I'm looking forward to the second half, because it is unknown territory, so I know I can do the fling, and I have done that you know, it's easier logistically to travel to the first half of the race and things. So I've done that part many times. And although I've been, you know, beyond Tindrum quite a few times as well, not as much, and just, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And just sort of seeing other people during the race and spending time with my support crew, I think particularly, I really enjoy running with Chris. He's really, really supportive and keeps you going really well. And same with Kia and Susan. I mean, she's doing the Edinburgh Marathon, first marathon on Sunday. And, you know, the two of us have worked really, really hard together this year on our different goals. And just, I think, I know she's really looking forward to the chance to support me because I've been doing a lot of support for her and things. So really looking forward to that. And I suppose, obviously, I then have to say that I'm looking forward to running with Neil as well, or he'll not be happy. So that's the main things I think about, and just the sense of achievement at the finish.
Yeah. And if you want a Katrina challenge, you could get Neil to get to tell you some things he appreciates about you.
Yeah, that would probably just cause an argument.
And then the final one: what does anything scare you at this point?
Not finishing, which, to be honest, I don't really think about it, actually. This throat thing, that's the worst thing that can happen for me, and does regularly happen, that would sort of slow me down and just makes everything so painful. And the other thing I do get quite worried about is the tiredness, particularly on that second night, not knowing how that's going to affect me and how I'm going to manage to keep going through it. I mean, I did keep going through a full night for the Cali Challenge, and that felt absolutely fine when you were doing it. It wasn't really till afterwards you noticed how tired you were, so I'm kind of hoping it will be like that. That's the main thing. Oh, and I suppose after 2 weeks ago, the weather, I mean, if it was as horrendous as it was, it would just be a nightmare. I'm going to pass on a tip that Andy Cole left on my blog the other day after reading the two-day race, which was marigolds for, well, I presume for over your gloves that would stop, you know, them getting soaked through. So I thought, I know I shouldn't care what I look like, but I don't really want to wear big yellow marigolds, so I'm going to get some of the wee hospital gloves that you wear when you're, you know, cleaning up things. So yeah, sure, we've got some in school.
Good, that's a good tip, yeah. I think someone else has done that before, so that's a good idea, yeah. Well, I must say, thank you very much, Caroline, for these. I think this is the fourth one we've done, isn't it, over the last few months. And it's been fascinating to watch your progress and see how you get on. And obviously, we'll be supporting you on the day and hoping it goes really well. And then we'd love to get you back afterwards as well. And hopefully you can talk about how it went. And so we wish you all the best in the race. And we hope you have a great time and you accomplish all that you want to do.
Thank you.
Well, the race is 4 weeks away today. It's the 26th of May, so 4 weeks' time. What time is it now? 10 to 8. People like Richard already be in, wouldn't they? Finish the race. But I thought it might be really helpful just to have a little bit of thoughts about tapering, because I know that's a big question for a lot of people about how to taper in the last 3 or 4 weeks before the race. And I thought, rather than just me talking about it, I've asked Neil, would he be willing to share some thoughts as well? But before we do that, Neil, do you want to just tell us about your day? You've been out supporting Caroline and Zilka, and Katrina went along as well. So tell us a bit about your day.
Oh, it's been an absolute scorcher out there on the West Highland Way. Been a cracking day. I've been driving from spot to spot, making sure they've had plenty of water and sun cream. And I've managed to do 13 miles myself in between. So, it's been a good wee day. The girls found it hard work in the heat. But they got there, and they've all had a great day.
And you ran part of the way in your five fingers?
I did the first 3 miles from the bottom of Devil's Staircase back towards King's House. It was a mile and a half out, mile and a half back in them. And I ran from Kinnock Leaven back up the hill and back down in them. And my feet are now agony, and it was too stony and not a good move. But I just love wearing them. They're good fun.
Good. Okay, so let's just think about tapering then, Neil. You've done the West Highland Way race twice, and indeed, I've done it five times. So maybe we'll just share a little bit about our own, what we did for our own tapering. So if you can think back far enough, how did you cope? What did you do over the last 3 weeks in both those races you did?
My tapering has always been the same for any race that I do, be it marathon or ultramarathon, or even, I suppose, 10K. And I only really ease off with 2 weeks to go, rather than 3 weeks, as you suggested there. Tapering's it's quite individual, and I think I like to think of it as a runner's marmite. You either love it or you hate it. A lot of people look forward to the taper, the chance to chill out and kind of rest up a bit, and a lot of runners get itchy feet and hate the taper. I'm on the hate it side. I love the theory of it. I love the idea that I'm not going to run, but then I hate actually not running. And when I do run, I find it really hard to run. And I find the 4 miler feels like a 20 miler. And I can't settle into a pace. I worry I'm going too fast, I worry I'm going too slow. I just find it really hard work. So I'm definitely of the hate Marmite brand of that one. But what I generally do is I'll train up, like I say, 2 weeks before. Do that last weekend, maybe up to 15 mile at top, something like that. And then during the week, maybe just an easy speed session or an easy hill session, a couple of easy runs. The final weekend, maybe a 6 mile or something like that. And then during the week, I always say I'm going to do a couple of 3 or 4 milers, and I always end up doing one. And as I've just said, hating it, it feels like a 20 miler. I feel like I could never run again. I dread the race, and it all goes horribly wrong. Hence why I hate tapering. I've been thinking about tapering today. Jonas said we might do this chat, and I've had a bit of time on my hands, so I've been thinking about it today, and I was thinking that if you look at your recovery for a race and reverse it, it would make a pretty good taper. If you've just done, say, a 50-mile race, whatever, like I did last week, you know, you're going to do very little the week after, and then you're going to start building up the second week. So the week after, you maybe do a couple of 3-4 mile easy runs, a fairly longer run the next weekend, and then maybe start doing some easy speed sessions. Mm. If you flip that round the other way, it works exactly the same way. In the same way that if you overcook your recovery, you don't recover as well. And if you don't do the taper, you don't perform as well on the day. So I think the two reflect quite well in that sense.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. It's good. I know for myself, again, I suppose I'm more on the Marmite hate side. I hate Marmite as well, by the way.
Yeah, likewise.
But I think for me, I remember the first year particularly, it just feels so horrible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you 3 weeks before, you think, right, now I need to start tapering. And you think you're going to and then suddenly I felt I'd lost all my fitness. With about a week and a half to go, I suddenly thought, I've got nothing, you know, it's all gone. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh, I need to go for a run. I need to put another big long run in. And but I didn't, you know, and I'm glad I didn't. And then I think the next year I was a bit more relaxed about it because I'd done it once. And I felt, you know, and for me, I got into a pattern of, I'd do the 2 day run about 5 weeks or 4 weeks before the race. And then 3 weeks before, I'd often do a night run from Mulgai to Balmahar or Mulgai to Drimmen and back, just to get a chance to run at night. And that would be my last long run. And then after that, it was every other day I would try and run and just try and do some easy runs just to keep the legs ticking over. But like you, Neil, I think you feel so sluggish. I think when you're used to running 5 or 6 times a week, and you're always running tired almost, aren't you? Because you're pushing it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're giving your body a little bit of rest and little niggles seem to come up. And I think that's perfectly normal. And I think most people find that.
Injuries you didn't know you had.
Yeah.
You suddenly start getting that case of shin splints that you've never ever had before suddenly flares up, or suddenly you get a tight hamstring that was never a problem before. And it is your body taking time to suddenly recover and to heal itself. You also start getting the sniffles and headaches and generally feeling run down and feeling like everything's going to crash down around you, don't you? You feel like it's just going to fall apart. But come race day, you probably still feel bad, but as soon as you set off, you just feel great. And it's the thing of tapering that you have to just understand that it's going to feel horrible, but when you set off, you'll feel great. So it's just trusting it.
Yeah. And I think for me, the last week, I've often done, probably the Sunday before the race, gone up onto the Braes and done my last sort of little run and tried to run maybe 6, 7, 8 miles. Mm-hmm. And then I've always had this thing where I like to do my final run going around Brodie Park, and I put all my kit on that I'm wearing. I remember the first year I actually ran around with my head torch on in the middle of the day because I just wanted to get used, you know, that final dress rehearsal, that final run. And then that was probably the Wednesday, so I had enough time to wash the kit and then get it ready for the Friday. I found that last week, maybe Monday, Wednesday I would run, or Monday, Tuesday even, and then just have 2 or 3 days to get ready. So we've talked about what we've done.
Make a point on that.
Oh, go on. Yeah.
I think it's well worth doing what John's just said, to go out and wear your full kit as you would on race day, but if it doesn't feel right for whatever reason, don't change it, because you've spent all this time getting that right, and if you now change it, the chances are, you know, it was just wrong on that day, and it's not going to be wrong on race day. Other thing I was just going to add there as well, I can't remember, is it Fiona or is it Tim that said the analogy of don't dig up the potatoes till they're ready? Don't feel you've got to go out there and bang out 20 miles just to test and see whether your legs are good enough. Just believe they are junior taper and test them out on race day.
Great, so there's a couple of thoughts, and I'm sure if you ask lots of different runners, they would have slightly different patterns of what they've done. But let's think, Neil, let's imagine that someone's sitting with us and they're just about to do the race for the very first time, and it's 3 or 4 weeks away from the race now. What advice would you give to someone for those last few weeks about how they should taper?
That's kind of as we've already said. It's just all about easing off and trusting you've done the hard work. We have got to that stage now where you can stop worrying about training and start worrying about your racing strategies, you know, your food and things like that, and making sure you've got all that right. So it's very much a case of, I would say, just get out and, you know, even leave your watch at home, just go out and some gentle jogs, enjoy your running. Remember why you run in the first place. It's, you know, to keep yourself healthy and because you love it. Similarly, if you start getting the whole not being able to sleep and worrying about the race, I know Caroline's getting to that stage, to stop worrying about it. You're doing this because you want to. You know, you want to do it. You love running. You love pitting yourself against the challenge and against nature. And you know, we all love doing it. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. So why get worked up about it? Just ease off. Get some easy runs in. Don't do anything stupid. Don't dig up the potatoes, as we said. Just believe it. Try and get as much rest as you can. Start thinking about food, which is another thing for the taper. Carbo loading. I know it has kind of some critics, whatever, but I always think if you can up your carbs in for the last kind of week, and make sure you've got plenty of fuel in your body. For something like the West Island, where you're going to run out of fuel whatever you do, aren't you? But the best you can do is get yourself well stocked up. Going from what I've done, ease off 3 to 2 weeks before, last run, longest run maybe 10-15 miles 2 weeks before, and then just whatever you fancy for a couple of weeks, basically just ease off, enjoy the chance to watch a bit of TV if you still want to. Just don't push it. Just trust in you've done all the hard work up until now.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. I think the other thing I would say is that the aim, isn't it, is to try and get to that start line at 1 o'clock on Saturday, the 23rd of June, as rested and as fit as you can. And I know that's easier for some. I always feel really sorry for, say, teachers who have to run the feet all day and have to work right until 3-4 o'clock. And then if they've got to travel, particularly if they've got to come up from England, and then, you know, it's a lot harder. I've always been able to take a day off, and I've used Friday just to try and chill out as much as I can, get my gear ready in the morning, make sure everything's ready, all my food's all packed, and then go back to bed in the afternoon and try and sleep for 2 or 3 hours. I don't often sleep, but I think just getting my pyjamas on and getting into bed, sometimes I put an eye patch on, and just try and doze a little bit, and then try and get up about 4 or 5 o'clock and feel as though, oh, it's a new day now, and try and trick your body into doing that.
The chances are you're not going to sleep.
No.
At the end of the day.
But I think just resting and just keeping off your feet as much as you can.
Definitely.
And so that whole sort of feeling of just trying to get to that start line as fresh as you can and as relaxed as you can will really help.
The thing to remember as well is that, you know, whatever you do in the 2 weeks beforehand is not going to improve your running ability. You're not going to make yourself a better runner for anything you do in those 2 weeks. What you can do is knacker yourself, break your ankle, whatever else, and not be able to run the race. So if you're struggling to taper, think of it that way. You're not going to give yourself any benefit, but you could do something detrimental to your race. So take the chance to relax a bit and not worry about getting long runs in and things like that. Take time to, you know, like I say, watch a bit of TV, go to the cinema instead, something like that. But John's quite right in what you're saying about the day before the race, or a couple of days before the race. You probably won't sleep because your body's not used to sleeping during the day, but just lying there. I remember, I think it was the first year I did it, I blacked out the windows with bin bags and everything, and I just lay there panicking. but I was still off my feet and lying in bed, and you're quite right, you do rest just doing that. So it's well worth, if you can get the day off work, taking it, I think, and trying to do something like that. As John said, for teachers like Caroline, they can't, so they've got to just do what they can.
Yeah. I think you're in an interesting position this year as well, having done the race, but now you're supporting Caroline. So maybe this would be helpful for people who are supporting runners. What do you think you'll be able to do over these next 2 or 3 weeks to help Caroline before the race?
Probably keep her out of the way as much as possible to avoid abuse when she gets stressed. Yeah. just reassuring. Caroline never listens to anything I say anyway. Unless John tells her it's right, then it's wrong from my point of view. She never listens to me, but just like we're saying, just encouraging people to ease off and that trust that they've done the work and that they can do it. Be positive around people. Same on race day, just be positive to your runner. Mm. Convince them that they can do it, that they're in good shape. Mm. And just, you know, make sure they do stay off the feet. And I guess if I have to admit it, I could do things like go make her a cup of tea so she doesn't have to walk to the kettle, but, you know. So, yeah, just be positive and just try and relax them as much as you can.
Yeah. It really struck me that's actually the whole idea of being positive about things. When I ran with Katrina, you know, on the fling, one of the things I was very aware of was just trying to keep the conversation positive. And I knew that if I said anything negative about, oh, I was a bit sore or anything, then that translates to her. Mm-hmm. And there was a few times when people caught us and I said, how are you doing? Oh, my leg's sore. And I, get away, go. Because I knew that as soon as you start to get negative thoughts, even last weekend when I ran with Dave, you know, I was saying earlier, we both had a bit of a dip when we came out of Coniston because we'd almost finished the race and then we had to get going again. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, we both had a struggle. And I'm sure it was more of a mental thing than a physical thing, but it does affect you physically.
And you drag each other down as well.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So I think, as you know, for those who are supporting runners, I think the more positive you are, then the more it's going to help. You know, they don't want to hear that you've had a struggle in the drive, getting to the next checkpoint or whatever else. They just want you to be as positive as they can. Mm-hmm. I think maybe near the time, the last one or two, I might do something about the last day or so, and maybe some tips on that might be helpful to do. But just on the tapering, any final thoughts?
I did just think of something, but it's gone right out of my head. What was I going to say? No, can't remember.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, if you do, we can add it in. So I would just encourage people to, as they think about the taper, always remember. Okay, so what was your mouth?
No, I've just gone back to being positive. For anybody who reads my blog, for the odd occasion that I write it, the Catron Trail or Catron Trail last week, I decided I was going to be a lot more Sharon Law and a lot less Thomas, or a lot, more to the point, a lot less me, and just remain positive and be upbeat and happy. And yeah. I think, I enjoyed the race a lot more, and B, with Caroline also being positive at the checkpoints, you know, it was far easier and far more enjoyable. Yeah. So you're quite right about being positive and trying to keep your runner positive, but as a runner, be positive as well. Yeah. You're going to have down points. There's no lying. You're going to have points when you just want to give up. Mm. But make the most of the good points. And when you are struggling, try and look about yourself and think, well, this is a fabulous place to be right now. Mm. Even if it does hurt, it's a beautiful part of the country. Mm. So just be positive as much as you can be.
Mm. I think my final thought was use this time as well just to visualise the race. Mm. I think that's something which I've enjoyed doing. You know, I love the fact that I can lie in bed now and I can pretty well visualise the whole route. And even when I'm out for those little runs before, just imagining where I'd like to be at each point and imagine what it's like to finish the race. Yeah. And the more you visualise, I think it does help. But again, it's just giving you those positive stimulus. Yeah, and particularly, definitely. I always find when I'm visualising races, I always beat you as well, you know.
That's about the only, right, 'cause I always beat you.
That's right. But, you know, things like that, I think, are really helpful, aren't they? Yeah. Just to use that time so that when you come to the race, you're full of positive thoughts, you've got little targets in mind of where you'd like to be, and I think that really helps.
Just don't spend the week before slamming into doors as if you finished the race. Every door you come to, just smashing into them.
Well, I do remember. I remember Dario saying that your time finishes when you hit those doors. Yeah. And that year when I was just under 20 hours, I wanted to make sure they heard, and they did. I could have broke my wrist, though. Yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much, Neil.
No problem.
And we look forward to hearing how you get on as support for Caroline. I put on Facebook that Neil and myself had done something about tapering and just asked people to share some of their top tips. Probably wasn't the best time to do it because a lot of people were out and about, Edinburgh Marathon and various things. But three people responded, so I'll read out some of their thoughts of what they think and what they do in regard to tapering. Ultra runner Moorsman said, "My taper consists of a totally non-run week prior to a long event or race, but includes a couple of short, brisk 2 to 3 mile walks to keep the legs moving." Rebecca Monroe said, "Don't eat lots of carbs the 2 days before. Start earlier in the week and eat normally beforehand." And Fiona Rennie, Next week I'm doing the 29-mile Isle of Bute run Victoria O'Reilly has organised. The following week, the Isle of Skye Half Marathon. It's no race though, just a lovely run. Then nothing more than 5 or 6 miles at an easy pace. Last run will be on the Tuesday before the race. I don't overeat beforehand, I just eat well. So thanks for your thoughts as well. Now when you work out where to draw the line, your guess is as good as mine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this latest podcast as we've thought about tapering, and particularly for those that are doing the race this year, we wish you all the best over these next few weeks, and it will be something that will continue to dominate your mind, and that's normal, and most of us go through that, but do make sure you rest well, make sure you get plenty of sleep, make sure you get your logistics in place, try and visualize that race and finishing well, and I do hope that you keep nice and healthy and get to that start line as fresh and as fit as you can. So thanks for listening, and remember, slow and steady wins the race. Say you're on your way down when God gave you style and gave you grace and put a smile upon your face.